Hi, everybody. This is Mike Oppenheim, and you are listening to Coffin Talk, Interviews with the Living, a weekly podcast that explores how our views on death affect the way we live our life. This week, we have our guest, Lisa Shukerman. She's an author, a nationally syndicated columnist, a survivor of suicide loss, a mental health advocate, a crisis counselor with the Trevor Project, and a storyteller with the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Welcome to the show, Lisa. How are you?
Hey, Mike. I'm great. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So we always ask our guests the same three questions to start the interview. And I know you live now just north of Boston, but where did you grow up? How old are you? And what generation, if any, do you consider yourself a member of?
Well, I was actually born on the West Coast, but my family lived here. I mean, my parents were considering moving out to the West Coast, and it just so happened I was born there while they were kind of thinking it through. But I've been back here on the East Coast ever since. I'm 55. I'll be 56 this summer. And I'm a member of Generation X, born in 1968. So that is my happy little cohort.
Awesome. I think we're going to start with a like awkward 9 million pound gorilla, which is in your bio. You talk about being a survivor of suicide loss. You, with whatever details you feel comfortable with, how would you explain to someone who asks you, what does that mean, a survivor of suicide loss?
Well, I mean, I'm a survivor, unfortunately, three times over. So I lost a cousin about a year or so before I lost my father. So I was 9 years old when my cousin took his life. I was 10 years old when my father took his life. And one of our closest friends took his life. It'll be 3 years this week, this Friday.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, me too. It sucks. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's everything about it sucks. And it's just, so it's a hard kind of loss to experience. There's just a nuance, or many nuances, I guess you could say, to suicide loss that just don't go along with, more traditional types of losses, like if someone passes away from a heart attack, or maybe they're passing away from a disease or an accident. That's a little bit more concrete. It's a little bit more, I guess, expected in some ways, that, you know, those are things that are, you know, can come up and take you without warning. And it's not anyone's fault, or it's not anyone's doing. Obviously, it's not something that's, you know, suicide is different, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'm tracking for sure. One thing that I've been thinking about in the last few years, and it was helped because one of my many jobs is I index books, which means I get paid to read a book and then write the index that gets put in the back. And this book was on the stigma of suicide, and it was tying it into mental health. And a thought occurred to me, and I don't think it's a popular or easy thing to say, but I think it's worth venturing with someone with your expertise. Mental health is a field, and it deserves respect, and it has a lot of like information in it. But is it necessarily a fact, according to like modern officials, that any person who takes their life is indeed someone with poor or bad or off mental health? Or is it possible that someone could be mentally healthy and still take their life?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a hard one. That's a really hard one, Mike, because, you know, again, there are so many different nuances to mental illness. And in most cases that I've ever seen, read about, heard about, encountered, someone is to some degree either depressed or, in a bad mental headspace prior to taking their life. I mean, it's a decision that someone who is in a kind of a sound state of mind, a healthy state of mind, is not going to make. And so, I mean, while I don't necessarily know what an actual statistic would be to answer that question with a statistic, every conversation I've ever had with any mental health professional or anyone who's lost anyone to suicide or anyone who's attempted to take their life, there's always a depression or a mental health issue attached to it.
And I figured that much, but I also just, I've been thinking recently about, because again, this is like a podcast that gets into metaphysics, and we only know what we know within this realm. And I am confident as a human, as a person, and as a thinker, that it would be nice for all people to have resources and places to go that would prevent taking a life or suicide. But what the book was also arguing is that this volley of conversation about it and the way it's talked about can actually create a stigma that makes people afraid to talk about it. So that's my next segue into, I mean, it's kind of an open question.
Yeah.
What is your suggestion to a person listening to this right now who has frequent enough thoughts that maybe they're a little worried?
Well, I mean, talking, let me backpedal for a second to what you just said about, you know, what you said about, you know, talking about it being perhaps a trigger that gets someone closer to making that decision to harm themselves or take their life. It's actually been proven. There have been so many studies that have been proven that by addressing someone's suicidality or, you know, poor mental health state, that's actually going to keep them from taking their life or harming themselves far more than by not addressing it at all. It's been proven that it actually, that can help de-escalate someone who's at that kind of that touch point where it could go either way. So what I would say to answer your question, I would say if someone who's listening to this right now is having a hard time, you're struggling, you can be self-aware enough to understand that you're in crisis, get help, call 988, talk to a friend, talk to a family member, talk to someone who you know that you can trust, where there's a safe space that you can be honest and vulnerable. Because if people don't know what's going on the inside, there's no way that somebody can help. And that's the hard thing. And I know that that was the case with two out of the three losses that I have, my father and my close friend, Steve, who passed away. We had no idea that either one of them were struggling. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about mental illness. Not only can it, you know, can it manipulate you and it can trick you and you know, it can be very deceitful. It's, there are people who are out there who are struggling beyond any of our imagination, and you don't know because they have that capacity to keep it to themselves, to kind of, you know, it's like that high functioning depression.
Yeah.
They can, or that high functioning mental illness where, you know, they have the ability to compartmentalize. So I would say if you know someone who's struggling and you've seen the signs, they're acting differently. They're pulling away. They're giving away possessions. They're canceling plans. They're just different. Mm-hmm. If it's someone close to you, you know when somebody's off. Ask the question, are you okay? Start with, are you okay?
Okay, cool.
And then if you're really worried and you really think something's imminent, ask someone directly. Say, are you thinking of killing yourself? Or are you thinking of harming yourself? And go from there. And everybody listening to this has a guaranteed thing in their pocket that they can turn to when they're in a situation like this. And that's 988. Every single time, if you're unsure, call 988.
That's great. And I really appreciate the way you answered that. And it's just, again, like, I don't wake up in the morning and be like, wow, I can't wait to call someone and talk about mental health and suicide. But I also do wake up in the morning and think, how can I contribute to human flourishing and life on Earth? And, you know, how can I just help others? I'm curious if this conversation we're having about how to speak to people is any different with children, whether it's your own or another, or if it's exactly the same.
Well, I mean, I think so. I've written a bunch of parenting books just for context. And before I kind of made the jump into the mental health space as an advocate and a crisis counselor and a storyteller, that was what I did for many, many years, probably close to a dozen years, you know, speaking on parenting platforms, writing on parenting platforms and whatnot. And so, I mean, and I have children who have, you know, experienced depression and mental illness and who have been in therapy and, you know, who have had their own struggles. And of course, I've not only had to share with them my father's suicide, but, you know, have navigated their mental health as well. So we're very open and honest. And in my family, we've always disclosed. We've disclosed everything, but it's age appropriate. You know, I mean, when my kids were old enough to know about my father's suicide, it was a few years after I found out about it. So I found out about it about 10 years ago. So I was in my mid-40s. My kids were like, one was in high school, one was going off to college. And so they were old enough to take all that in and to really have a very honest and open conversation about it. And I think, you know, there are definitely ways that you can talk to younger kids that's an age appropriate way. Like, you know, maybe instead of coming outright and explaining suicide, because that concept at that age, a young kids aren't going to be able to understand and process it the way that, you know, older kids or young adults will. So maybe you talk about their, you know, someone's brain being sick. Like a young child can understand sickness and someone not being well. And so you explain it and you say that their brain isn't healthy and their brain isn't well, and it maybe makes them think differently or act differently. And so I think it really just depends on the kids. It depends on the age. It depends on the circumstance, you know, but we've always tried to be really super honest with our girls in every way. especially in terms of mental health. And that's just created a really great, foundation for communication within our family. And everybody else that I know personally who have had to deal with the hard things with their kids, they're the ones who are open with them and honest with them in as much as they can.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you're tired of answering these line of questions, but I have to ask. I'm a fan of Jonathan Haidt and a lot of his work, and he recently came out with a book all about teenagers and children and social media and the devastating effects. Mm-hmm. Just for context for you, I have an 8-year-old son, mm-hmm. a 2.5, almost 3-year-old daughter, and then a newborn who's like about 8 weeks old.
Oh, wow.
And I have different theories and opinions, but I know that for myself, I've never been a fan of social media. It didn't seem attractive to me. Mm-hmm. I'm reluctantly on it. I don't feel a lot of like human connection on it. But the one thing it has done for me is it's absolutely killed my self-esteem. I mean, it has just made me realize mm-hmm. that I don't have what I think I have. And I know that that's fake and false and all that, but I'm just relating to you how much in my limited scope of social media that affects me. I can't even fathom what it would be like to be a child right now with a 24/7 culture of like have and have not, bullying, popularity, checking in and all that. So I'm going to start with the most basic question. If there was like a law to ban social media from children in the same way we try to ban marijuana, drugs, and alcohol, would you be in favor of that? Or do you think there's a much better way?
Well, I think there's a much better way. I'm not like an extremist one way or the other mm-hmm. with certain things. I believe in moderation being the key to most things. I believe in kind of, the positive pieces of something like social media, for instance, since that's what we're talking about. You know, I believe that there's a lot of value there. I believe that there's opportunity there to make different kinds of connections, to create different kinds of learning environments, to see different parts of the world and different cultures. And so, from that standpoint, like all of the obvious positives, I think are worthwhile. There's a lot of crap out there. There's a lot of pitfalls. It's difficult. I mean, I think that there should be constraints? Absolutely. Do I think that anything, that also has that much value should be banned altogether? No, I don't. But I think that there should be some restrictions, some appropriate restrictions. And that starts with parenting. Mm-hmm. My kids were kind of in a weird place on the social media curve because they didn't have phones until they were like in middle school, but they were basically like, they were like one step away from a burner phone. It was just to be able to get in touch with me or my husband. We were all in different places, different schools. And, I need a ride or I'm going to be late. That was the extent of their social media for a very long time and their phone capacity. But, and they weren't living in a world that's, a TikTok world and an Instagram world and a Snapchat world. I mean, it was very different for my kids. That was just emerging. And so they kind of grew with it. They grew up with it, but we gave, we always had rules in our house, like no phones at the table, no phones in a restaurant. We limit set. And I think that's where it has to start. I mean, legislation is a whole different conversation. It's a whole different animal. The basic answer to your question is, I do believe that there has to be some greater moderation that takes place mm-hmm. just to ensure that these kids are not being subjected to all of the damaging and in so many cases catastrophic, just byproducts of social media, like exactly what you talked about, like imposter syndrome or, mm-hmm. or comparison traps or, bullying or any of the other stuff. And it's difficult. I mean, it's really difficult to know kind of where the lines are and how you draw them. But, I'm in favor of it all to a point, but I definitely believe in some heavy moderation.
Cool. That answer very much gels with me. And that's why I said I'm reluctantly on it, but it's not like I think it's, the reincarnate of Satan or something like that. I do, And also like the thing about, and this is my next question for you, what actually irritates me the most about the modern era is families in restaurants with kids with headphones on and iPads. It just drives me nuts. Yeah. I think it's like ridiculous and unhealthy. And I have enough people who listen to this and I know who are going to be offended that I'm sharing this opinion so vociferously, but I don't care. I've had it. I just think it's ridiculous. So my question is a little different. It's not like, should that be allowed or not? It's more, if you're a parent and you're already trapped in that paradigm, you've made the mistake or whatever, and you've let them do it, and now you want out, is there a way out?
I think there's always a way out. I mean, I think that there's always a way to kind of backpedal a little bit and recover or regroup. Like, we're a work in progress, right? So we're always learning, we're always growing and evolving. And look, we're figuring out parenting while our kids are figuring out how to be humans. So there's a learning curve for everybody. And I absolutely believe that we all have the capacity to, you know, kind of regroup and fix our mistakes, because we're making mistakes all the time. You know, no one's going to raise the perfect child or be the perfect parent. So, I mean, in that context, I think that, you know, first of all, for the record, and for anybody who's listening to this, I 1000% support your position on that. I mean, I think it's first of all, there are so many different reasons why I support it. It's, you know, it's difficult to name them all, but it's rude behavior to have a kid with a blasting tablet in a restaurant. It's, you know, don't even get me started about kind of, you know, preserving the essence of like the coming around the dinner table, wherever that dinner table is, if it's in your house or if it's in a restaurant or if it's a friend's house, like that's a special time where people are bonding and they're getting together, and sometimes for the first time during their entire day. And to kind of contaminate that by throwing a tablet in front of a kid's face is a missed opportunity, and it's setting a really bad precedent. So that's kind of how I feel. Like, I'm just saying how I feel. I'm not judging anyone who chooses. Like, raise your kids however you're going to raise your kids, but don't be surprised when the things that you do or don't do come back and bite you in the ass when your kids are older. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, for lack of a better way to say it. But look, I mean, you know, you can always redirect. You can always kind of modify the behavior and just say, you know, you and your partner can decide, you know, we're changing the rules. And there's nothing wrong with that, because you're the parent, and you get to do little experiments with your kids to see what works and what doesn't, and get buy-in from them by saying it's an experiment. And, you know, let's have a challenge. Let's, you know, it's all how you frame it, right?
Yeah.
Let's challenge ourselves. Who can get through dinner without a screen for a week and see how that goes, and offer something different, and offer something you can do as a unit. So there are different ways that you can kind of back out of those situations.
That's great. No, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate you explaining it the way you did. I like your sense of humor. And I think, you know, we're all judging each other. Like, I have friends who, if I tell them I'm not going to let my kid have an Apple Watch when they're six, they're going to judge me for the exact inverse reason. They're going to be like, oh, you're a Luddite. You're not enabling your kid to live in society. And I think this also ties into the metaphysical concepts of like, well, what is the meaning of life? If it's to be happy and joyous and be entertained, then there's nothing wrong with staring at an iPad all day. If there's infinite entertainment, infinite scroll. I don't believe that, but I absolutely would understand that argument. We always ask every guest one other question, which is, what do you think happens when you die? And so for you, I would like to know, what do you think happens when you die? And does in any way affect your advice for both suicide and parenting?
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to Coffin Talk. I am proud to say that we are offering premium subscriptions at my website, mikeyopp.com. That's MIKEYOPP.com. So please head over and consider supporting us. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, I mean, I definitely believe that there is something beyond here. Like, our consciousness, I can't possibly imagine that human consciousness stops when our physical bodies don't have the capacity to hold us anymore. I just can't believe that. I'm a way more spiritual person than I am a religious person, but I absolutely believe that our consciousness, our presence, our being, our spirit, whatever you want to call it, it transcends. It goes somewhere. I think that it seeps into the people we love, the people we've lost. I think that we are somehow reconnected with the earth around us, and kind of the greater universe. I mean, it doesn't affect the way that I feel about suicide. I don't think that anything different happens if someone dies by suicide. And that's because anyone who takes their own life has got a much deeper, darker mental health issue going on that's putting them in that position, you know, that's created that chaos in their brain. So I don't think any differently of it in terms of suicide. And, you know, as far as, you know, kind of being a parent.
Does your parenting philosophy have any sort of religious or spiritual concepts to it? Meaning you would strongly suggest to people like, hey, you shouldn't tell your kids nihilism is what it's all about. It's just like a big bang and then you're just here and you die. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. I'm not trying to prod you in either direction.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And I'm totally open about all of that. I mean, you know, we're Jewish. I'm Jewish. My husband is Jewish. Our family has been, you know, we've raised our children to be Jewish. We've exposed them to our religion, our background, our upbringing. And we actually had this conversation with one of our daughters the other night, as a matter of fact, and our youngest is going to be 24. And, you know, we always laugh because she couldn't stand Hebrew school. No kids ever. One stands Hebrew. Everyone hates it. So, you know, she reminded us how much she hated it. You know, loved the people who taught her, but hated going. And we said, look, you know, we're not, as parents, and I'm only speaking for myself and my husband, Dave, we have exposed our children or tried to expose our children, and this transcends just religion, but I'll focus it on religion. We've exposed them to as much as we have the capacity as humans to expose them to. We've exposed them to our views on everything that I guess you can have a view on, because we're their parents, we're the people they get their opinions from, but we've done it in a way, or we've tried to do it in a way that isn't jamming anything down their throat. There's been no expectation in terms of this is what you need to believe. What we've always done with everything, whether it's be about, you know, life and death, whether it's been about work and love, whether it's been about, you know, religion or politics, it's always like, look, here's where we stand. Here's where we are. This is what we feel. And this is why. And you are your own human being. And you're not just getting all your input just from us. It's a much bigger, broader world. You've got friends, you've got family, you've got colleagues, you've got teachers and professors and a world full of knowledge and understanding, and you're going to have to figure out what you believe on your own. So that's kind of where we're at. We showed them where they were from. We kind of took them along that journey, and then we've given them the opportunity to make the decisions about what they believe and how they believe on their own.
And I have a sort of specific question. It's again in line with projecting the age of my own children into the future and looking at how children are behaving now. And so without knowing anything about your daughters, who are, I'm presuming, mm-hmm. both in their 20s.
Yeah.
When I was young, I graduated in 1999. It was absurd to stay at home at your parents' house. Even if you weren't going to college, you like figured out how to get a job, pay rent, and move out. That was just like a social norm. And it was, it was almost impossible to like continue and have like real adult friendships and relationships, especially if you didn't. Whether that's good or bad is kind of what I'm getting at. Now, for financial reasons, but also emotional reasons, there's like a much larger percentage of people who are living with their parents into their 20s and even 30s. I'm just curious. I really don't have a pointed question to this. I'm just curious what you think about all that.
It's very funny. So timing is everything, Mike. It's very, very funny that we're having this conversation today, the day that my 24-year-old, almost 24-year-old, just signed a lease on her first apartment.
Wow. Great. Congratulations.
Yeah. I will congratulate her. Yeah. She'll appreciate it. So the way that we feel is you're absolutely right about the world has changed so much. And I think what kind of the catalyst for a lot of that change was the pandemic. You know, I mean, we went through this, you know, global catastrophe that changed everything. It changed the way we work, changed the way we went to school. It changed the way, you know, we lived and operated in the world. And it, I think, continues to evolve, but the way that it impacted our kids, like, so my girls were out of college at that point. We didn't have to navigate the being in school portion because they were already out, but we kind of dodged that bullet. But I mean, my youngest has been with us and for the last several years and saving money. And, you know, she works in special education at a school in our hometown. And, you know, and every teacher needs a side hustle just to barely make a living. So she's been actively saving to move out. But, you know, it's so different now. I mean, we see so many of her friends, even so many of my older daughter, who's going to be 27, her friends, they're all going back home. They're all living it. First of all, I mean, I don't know where you're from, but I'm right north of Boston. And it is so prohibitive. I don't care what kind of a job you have. Yeah. It is so prohibitive for kids today to be able to even exist outside, you know, the home, you know, their family home on their own salary. I mean, it's such, I don't know what the statistic is off the top of my head, but I mean, it's just so difficult unless you have a roommate, unless you are living in a, you know, a crappy apartment or, you know, you've got some kind of inheritance or trust fund. Like, it is really, really difficult. And because of that, you're right. There's been such a movement to stay home, to save money. And, you know, a lot of, there's a whole generation now, you know, the younger generation of kids are starting to move in with their grandparents because they're keeping their grandparents company and acting as caregivers while they're also taking advantage of being able to save money and not having to pay rent. So there are all these little micro movements that are kind of have taken off. And, you know, look, I come from a family and my husband comes from a family where my parents, their grandparents lived with them. My grandparents lived with me. My husband's grandparents lived with him. So it's like we have always come from a place of that family, you know, living together and grandparents being a part of the equation and kids coming back and staying home with the family after college. So we always had that kind of dynamic in our family. And we're very fortunate that our family of four is a very, very tight unit. And we love having our kids around. One of my daughters actually lives in Japan, so she is most definitely not around. Mm-hmm. But our youngest is here and we've told her she can stay as long as she wants. And, you know, she was the one who got to the point and said, you know what, I feel like I need my own independence and I think it's time. And so, you know, she finally reached the point where she saved enough to be able to do what she wanted to do. But I mean, I'm all for it. I love the idea of that family unit being able to stay together and, you know, and enjoy each other and take advantage of that time. So I was super grateful when everybody was home during the pandemic. That was just, that was such a gift as far as I was concerned. So, I felt lucky to have those extra few years with all my kids.
Yeah, that was what I wanted to hear because as a father, but also as a son, I was raised in the Bay Area of California and then my parents, when I went to college, moved to Iowa. So they left where I was from. So it got awkward because I would have to like take certain vacations back to see my friends and then some to see them. Then they eventually moved to Phoenix. And so in my late 30s, I moved with my family to Phoenix to be closer to them. So, and it's because I feel exactly how you do, which is why on earth would I put my career or other weird reasons ahead of like what my favorite thing on earth is, which is family, people who love me, understand me. Sure, we have conflict, but we work through it. Unlike a lot of conflict with strangers where you just either pass the buck or move on or, you know, do something weird. So I'm really glad you said that. And I think COVID was a blessing in disguise for many and it was the worst thing ever for many. And I don't need to get into that, but you know, for me, it meant more time with people I love and a slower pace of life. So I don't think I want COVID to come back and I don't want any pandemic, but I would like to see the shift that you're describing and also to focus on the values because I think, you know, going back into the social media thing, there would just be less mental illness that is not biological. So the other kind, because there's really two, if people had more support and more family. And so I hope, and that's why I mentioned it the way I did about 1999 is it wasn't like, I want to leave. It was more like, if I don't leave, I'm a air quotes loser. And I, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it was like, that was the big push. I also, you know, like wanted to play in a band and see the world and all that, but that's very normal. You can still see the world and go back home. So thank you so much for that answer. And thank you for all your answers.
Yeah.
We always give our guests the last question. We just kind of open-endedly ask you, what would you like to tell our audience? It can be about anything you want.
You know, I think since my sweet spot right now is mental health and wellness, I would just tell people, you know, kind of getting back to what you and I talked about in terms of like social media and all of those pressures and kind of the inescapability of it. It's always there. It's always kind of, you know, that thing that we compare ourselves and other people to. I think in the spirit of that, I would just say, you know, give yourself some grace. Be where you are right now. You know, allow yourself the latitude to just be present, to kind of follow your own path, not compare yourself to other people. We're, you know, we get so caught up in that. It's difficult to get away from it. But if we give ourselves grace and we stay exactly where we are right now and be present, honestly, I think that's the best gift we can ever give to ourselves.
Thank you so much, Lisa. This was a wonderful conversation. It's not easy to talk about parenting. Everyone loves to tell parenting experts that they're wrong and to take offense to it. And it's also not easy to talk about mental illness. So thank you. And everyone listening at home, once again, the best way to support the show is just to head over to MikeyOpp.com. That's MikeyOpp.com. I write a weekly philosophy comedy newsletter as well as releasing the podcast. And you can sign up for free over there. Thank you again for listening to Coffin Talk. My name is Mike Oppenheim, and we will see you soon.